What happened when you were 30 that made you accept or be glad that you were Black?
I think for so long, either I wanted to be, you know, my nose to be thinner. I wanted my hair to be straighter and blonde. I wanted to be the European style of beauty. It took me a long time to say, you know, I am smart and I am beautiful and I am okay and I am enough.
That's Tiana Clark. She's a poet. And the opening line of one of my favorite poems of hers, Equilibrium, goes like this. Took me 30 years to say, I'm glad I don't pass for white. Her words are powerful. So powerful that I've wanted to interview her ever since I first heard her at a poetry reading in Nashville. Normally on this show, I talk to three different people in front of a live audience, and there's only so much time I can spend on each one. So this is a new experimental format where I dive deep with one person. And if there's anyone who's cool with diving deep, it's Tiana Clark. She writes about race and Southern history and religion and sex.
I want to talk about the elephant in the room. I want to talk about the uncomfortable things. I don't like pleasantries. I don't know how to be fake. I think that's why it's hard to have a poet in the family.
Just a warning, we do talk about some risque and potentially uncomfortable topics right off the bat. We'll also talk about what's off limits in her writing and how she feels about being kind of a poetry rock star. I'm Emily Seiner, and this is Movers and Thinkers. For this episode, I'm sitting across from Tiana in her living room, and I ask her to read something from her book of poetry, Equilibrium. It's a poem called Exorcism. It's about watching a girl get overtaken by a religious experience in church.
Oh, yeah. I haven't read that in a while.
And just a note, I'm taking out several lines in the middle for time, but you can find the whole poem online.
Exorcism. Pastor John stood over her body, shouted scripture as she writhed in the jerk of undulations that lit her bones on fire. Her eyes, slick as marbles, slid to the back of her head. Only the white jelly of sclera shone between the flutter of eyelash flicks moored to the mouth of some netherworld. I stood back in awe and in horror, like the first time I watched porn, excited because we were inside the same heat, as each of our hands stretched forward, flexed as church fans, we stroked the flames of spirit higher and higher. Pastor John said she had a demon of lust, a Jezebel spirit. He said we had to pray louder and harder, had to touch her arms and her sides, had to deliver the ember of her sins from the second crust of hell. But I knew this girl that twitched on the floor, Sarah, my older friend. And yes, she made out with the boys, and yes, I saw how the boys looked at her breasts, like the way they looked at them now when she jiggled, buoyant as sunny side up eggs. As if I could pierce her yolks with my praying fingers, bloodletting, buttery sex. She was like me, a girl with no father, a girl that made God her father, a girl that wanted to be saved, but mostly to be loved. She gave her body to greasy boys the way she gave her body in that musty chapel outside of the gold buckle of the Bible Belt to all of us.
The descriptions in that poem are so, like, carnal and...
Oh, that's a good word, carnal.
And almost erotic.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that's on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about religion that links it to sex?
For me, I'm very interested in the intersection between the sacred and the sexual because they both have to do with the body. And growing up in church and thinking about Eucharist, you're literally told that you're eating the body of Christ. That is also very carnal to think about. Like, eating the bread is the flesh of Christ. The wine is the blood. And as a kid, you're just like, nom, 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 grape juice and like a wafer. But then when you get older and you really think about what you're being told, you're like, what? And as a poet, I'm just like, that is insane. And I think for me too, growing up in church, there was such a sense to be loved by a higher power, to be needed, to be wanted, to be involved in the fervor of an experience like this scene that's happening, that I think you have those same feelings in sexual experiences too. You want to be seen, you want to be wanted, you want to be desired. You want to be overwhelmed by something other than yourself. It's so close to the pain and pleasure of church. And I love kind of, as a poet, smashing those things together.
Have you had any religious experiences that have felt sexual or sexual experiences that have felt religious?
There was another experience at church. Actually, one of my very first sexual experiences happened at church. And It was so interesting. For the longest time, I thought it was a totally normal experience. Although I was really young, I had just turned 12, and it was with a boy that was much older. And looking back now through therapy, I was like, oh, like that was definitely a form of like sexual assault. But I think my child mind was like, oh, I just had a crush on this person. And thinking that when you're at church, there's a sense of safety there and that everyone has pure intentions. And that's not always the case, you know? It was interesting when that experience actually got exposed at the church. I had to go talk to the head pastor, not the boy, of course. And I was told that basically it was my fault and that I put myself out there to be taken advantage of, that he compared it to baseball and like I was a catcher, that I don't need to throw every ball that's thrown. Like I don't need to catch every ball that's thrown to me. I think that was the metaphor. So I was like, there was a baseball metaphor and something that was my fault. That's all I remember.
That sounds really traumatic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in the event that inspired the poem called Exorcism, Tiana says she saw an older male church leader on top of a girl she knew. And she recognizes now that it felt uncomfortable, even if she didn't realize it at the time.
I obviously got lodged in there somewhere in the old memory banks. I don't remember being alarmed because it was something that kind of happened regularly at our church. But I think you slowly start questioning things. When they taught us about sex in church, and like the boys went in one room and the girls went in another, and the boys were taught about sex, and the girls, they were like, well, you're a princess, a daughter of the king, you're angels. And I was like, but we need to learn about masturbation too. Like, we need to know about our bodies. I remember saying that at a very young age. And they were like, Tiana, they're like, shh, shh.
So how did you even know about that?
I was always really tall, so people always thought I was older. So I just think I acted like I was older too. And I was just, you know, I was home alone watching MTV and like the real world. So like, I knew it was up at a very young age. I just, I think I was interested in things that were off limits and off topic and taboo, which makes sense now that I'm a poet. Because I like, you know, I want to talk about the elephant in the room. I want to talk about the uncomfortable things. I don't like pleasantries. I don't know how to be fake. I think that's why it's hard to have a poet in the family.
Are you still a religious person?
I would definitely claim I'm a spiritual person. I don't go to church anymore, but I definitely think I still have a personal relationship with God. I don't know. Organized religion is tough for me. I do think that for me, writing poems is a type of church. I actually have a group called Poetry Church because we meet on Sundays. And I think to me, like, I've experienced a holiness in writing poems and connecting to a higher power. Sometimes when I'm writing my poems, I get like, I'm like shaking or vibrating. I do sense this like other thing in me that's just kind of beyond myself.
We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk more about the hazards of writing about family. Stick with us. Welcome back to The Interview. I'm talking to poet Tiana Clark about writing about her innermost thoughts. She says this has been uncomfortable for people for a while.
My mom got me a diary when I was younger. And like the very first thing I wrote in my diary was like, sometimes I hate my mom. And I locked it and she of course busted it open and read that. And she was like really upset with me. And I'm like, you just totally invaded my privacy, which is such a great example for like what happens when you write about family.
But she carries on with family-related writing anyway, like in this poem called Soil Horizon. She recently won the Vanderbilt University Poetry Prize for it, and it's based on taking a family picture at a former plantation. She'll just read the first part of it.
My husband's mother wanted to take the family portrait at Carton Plantation. I was the only person she called to ask if it was okay. She said we could redeem the land with our picture. My brown skin acrostic to the row of their white. She said, can't we just let the past be the past? I was silent, my cell phone glowing warm against my cheek. I was driving, red light, then go. She said, it's practically in my backyard and that her boys played on buckled fields of green graves growing up. There are so many fun places to shoot. Oh, and that big magnolia is in bloom. Fragrant, milky petals and waxy greens by the red brick house in the large front porch with rocking chairs tipping back and forth above the purpled stains of Confederate blood. I said it was fine as long as we weren't by the slave cabins, and she laughed, and I laughed, which is to say, I wasn't joking at all. She kept saying redeem as if to say we'll make it acceptable, restore and atone, buy it back, pay it off. We'll redeem it, she said again. Emancipate. Liberate. Her voice swelling like she was singing, and as if we really could. How do we stand on the dead and smile? I carry so many black souls in my skin, sometimes I swear it vibrates like a tuning fork when struck.
Did you feel uncomfortable writing that poem?
Yes and no. I often write about just racial kind of trauma. As a writer, for me, the entry point is the more personal I can make the poem, the more universal it becomes. We have all these plantations here. And to me, there's kind of like this over, this glorification, this romanticized view. I mean, people get married there. There's graduation pictures there. And to me, it's just like, that would be like me taking like a graduation picture at like, you know, a concentration camp, you know, like it just doesn't make any sense to me. I understand preserving history. I understand that we need to, you know, maintain some of these sites. But I think oftentimes I've been to some of the tours, they either don't talk about it at all, or if you ask a question, they'll like acknowledge it, but it's definitely like not a main part of the tour. And there's a certain part about, to me, poems ask questions, and I'm asking a question of this land. And even though it's about an adjacent story that happened with my family, it's about, I think, the larger kind of slice of that land and how all of us in the South are implicated in what happened.
When I read this, I was sort of like, damn, she's calling out a family member.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide what's off limits to you?
For a while, I used to be under this thing that I had to have permission to write something. If I wrote about someone, that I had to have permission. But I don't necessarily feel that anymore. Personally, when I teach my students, I say nothing is off limits. But there's also the poem that you write and the poem that you publish. And sometimes the demons that you exercise on the page maybe don't need to be seen by everybody. It's a hard negotiation as an artist. It takes a certain type of bravery and courage to be able to reveal these truths. And to me, though, what makes it worth it is when I read this poem recently at Swanee, and this girl came up to me afterwards and she was like, I actually had my graduation pictures at Carton Plantation and I had no idea that there were slaves there. Which part of me was like, where did you go to high school? And then second of all, it was just like, this is why poems are important and this is why I can't hide this story or bury this story. Like, I'm not in the business of not living and speaking my truth, and I have to reflect that truth in my work.
Are there topics or people that you used to not be able to write about that now do?
For a while, I was kind of afraid to talk about my marriage or my husband. I had this poem called Honeymoon Sex. And the poem was basically about, like, we had kind of done the, you know, saved ourselves for our wedding night. And it just, like, wasn't that great. But I think people, like, sell that lie a little bit.
So she told her husband she wanted to read this poem out loud to an audience, and he wasn't sure if he was okay with it.
But on the day of, he came up to me and he was just like, if you can be brave, I can be brave with you. There were so many women crying in the audience when I read that poem, and that's what the truth does. Because I don't feel alone anymore. That's why one of the reasons why I write, people want connection. People want to say, like, you felt that, like, you experienced that pain too. Like, I thought I was the only one that...
Is there anything else in particular that you feel comfortable writing about and sharing publicly now that you wouldn't have when you started?
Well, I think what's interesting now is that I actually lie a little bit more than I did in the past. When I first started writing poetry, I was very beholden to the truth. Like, everything had to be 100% true. And it's not necessarily that I blatantly lie about a certain fact, but I'm definitely massaging things to, like, make sense. I think before, I would get stuck on the exact details and I would get like speed bumps in my work. So actually now, stepping into like getting to the emotional truth, which is actually truer than the truth, if that makes any sense.
So your mom is black, mm-hmm. And your dad is white.
Yeah.
And you grew up with your mom. How were you taught to see yourself growing up?
Ooh, we were born in Los Angeles when I moved to Nashville when I was 7. And, you know, and Los Angeles, it was so diverse and everyone was different. It was like, it's a small world after all in my kindergarten class. But then when I moved to Nashville, when it was like 90% white, and I was like 1 in 4 black kids, all the time I got asked the question, like, what are you? And I would go home and be like, Mom, what am I? And she would just say, you're beautiful. So I go back to school and I'd be like, I'm beautiful. And then they would like make fun of me. But of course I was consumed with like, you know, seeing MTV and reading Cosmo and these images just being thrusted upon me of like, what is beauty at a young age? And I thought beauty was being, you know, skinny and white and having big boobs. So those were the things that like I wanted.
Hearing you read your poems is such a powerful experience because I really just get what you're trying to say. Do you feel like you write it more for a reader or a listener?
Mm. You know, when I first started writing, I started writing at Hume Fogg High School with a great teacher named Bill Brown. But one day he brought a metronome to class and he said that even if your poems don't rhyme, your poems always follow a beat and have a rhythm. And I feel like sometimes I still carry that click with me, that sense of rhythm in a poem. Oftentimes when I write, I'm saying the poem out loud. I'll just print out the poem and I'll just read it and I'll record myself and listen back. And sometimes I can hear, okay, where's my breath getting caught? Where am I getting stuck on a line? And so I'll actually revise off of my breath that way.
Can you make good art if you don't tap into pain?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, good art is so subjective. I mean, I think for me, I just have my personal aesthetic. So like, I love a poem that's going to punch me in the gut, that makes me feel something, that like wakes me up. I mean, for me, I think the kind of call is to like step in the middle of that pain and let it ping you, you know, and it's like, you can't stay in those places for a very long time because it can be very, very taxing. But I think art that goes through a process of exploring pain is really fascinating to me.
Not just to her. Even in the past year or so, Tiana has been accumulating poetry accolades like it's her job, which it is, so that's good. She has a year-long poetry fellowship starting this fall. She's gotten a lot of awards. She has a forthcoming poem in The New Yorker. And that's all very impressive. But I think what really strikes me is just when I go to your readings in Nashville, the rooms are packed. It's often standing room only. And just, you just have this star power that I don't typically associate with poetry. Do you see part of your mission as making poetry cool to the masses?
I think it is cool. I think it already is cool. But no, I hear what you're saying. I feel that way for so many other poets. You know, like, it's hard to talk about myself in this way.
I know.
But at a very early age, I remember someone came up to me and they were like, hey, I thought I didn't like poetry, but I like your poems. And I think what people are really saying is, I thought poetry was this like other thing that's really like kind of dusty, cloister in the halls of academia, like old white man talking about birds and rivers, which is beautiful. We all love our Wendell Berry. That's beautiful. But I think I'm interested in kind of redefining what poetry is and what it looks like and what package it comes in. And I think a lot of people aren't familiar with the contemporary poetry scene. A lot of my students, for example, on the first day of class, I had all my students bring in one of their favorite poems. One person brought in a contemporary poet. The rest were old dead white guys, because I think that's the only exposure that they had in high school. You got your Walt Whitman, you got your T.S. Eliots. You might have got some British romantic poets in there, a little Emily Dickinson, and you were good to go. So, you know, the first day of class, I would tell them, like, you are about to be a deluge of contemporary poets and figuring out what we're doing. Because a lot of contemporary poets, you know, are doing what I'm doing. And it's this kind of fusion of the stage meets the page, where it's performance and storytelling and narrative, you know.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying not to talk about myself. It's very cool to like have that exposure. It's very cool. I'm always very flabbergasted when people show up at my readings. It feels amazing. Being a poet is like the biggest dream I've ever had. And to me, it's so insane that I get to be a full-time writer. Like, people ask me all the time, like, hey, what do you do? I'm a poet. And they're like, no, but what do you really do? I'm like, no, I'm really a poet. And they're like, okay, like, how do you make money? And I'm like, poetry. Like, it's just insane that I get to live this life. And I like, pinch myself daily.
Well, Tiana, thank you so much. Thank you so much for letting me talk to you. It's been really fascinating.
I appreciate it.
That was Tiana Clark. You can find more of her work on her website, tianaclark.com. Movers and Thinkers is edited by Mac Linebaugh and Anita Bug, and it's mastered by Carl Peterson. Kim Green is our sponsor liaison. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. If you love Movers and Thinkers, good news, we now have a lot of podcasts you can listen to. Find our whole fleet of shows at podcasts.wpln.org. I'm Emily Siner, and this is Nashville Public Radio.